This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Good morning, everybody. First thing I'll say to you is that I'm not an expert on shared services or procurement. Joyce, who you heard from a bit earlier, Colin and indeed others are much more expert on the subject than I am. So in the best traditions of how to stimulate debate, I'll be slightly provocative rather than slightly expert on this particular subject. So that's the story in advance. As Tony's just been describing, we are in an incredibly complex change environment, not just financially or indeed economically in terms of globals, but as Tony was absolutely spot on a second ago and the last question we had, I think, is a really interesting one. The way I always think of this is that we are living through an age where customers, citizens, residents expect, and rightly expect and demand us to provide the best possible in the way that we go about things that we do. The way I always think of it, though, is that they demand Swedish-level services and United States-level tax bases. And that is the fundamental problem that we have. And I don't want to dwell on that because I think that point's been well made. But it is, nonetheless, a very important contextual point. Second point is that we are living through a period of significant public sector reduction. I'll just give you the figures for my own organisation. You'll know your own organisations. Mine, I have to say, is probably worse than most people's in the room. £91 million we've taken out of our budget this financial year. 91. That's from what we refer to as a controllable spend. Sorry for the jargon, but that basically means the stuff that we can actually get our hands on, of about 400. So about 25% from a standing start. I was talking to a colleague just before the coffee break about the fact that if I worked in a different sector, I would get all sorts of commendations for saving £91 million. Instead, in the local government world that we're in at the moment, I get a reward by being featured in the Sunday Times, Daily Telegraph, Daily Mail, and all other media of that persuasion. An interesting reflection on, again, the social point that, that Tony was just talking about before. I'm not one for models, per se. Tony and academic colleagues, much more intelligent about these kind of things, much more analytical, perhaps, than I would be about this. But it is clear that the model that we've grown up with is not going to be sufficient, appropriate, fit for purpose for the challenges that we currently face. Whether you do that historically, whether you do it in terms of sector, whether you do it in terms of the different forms of local government in this country. And bear in mind, I've worked in unitaries or metropolitans most of my career and a spell in two-tier in Lancashire comparatively recently. And I know which of those two settings I would choose for those of you in the two-tier world. We'll maybe discuss that shortly. But my point is a very serious one, which is that the complexity of the local government world, the landscape, the extent of centralisation versus localism, does actually have a material and significant impact on the way in which we are able to do things. Joyce was describing when I first came in a bit earlier about the experience of the kind of what I refer to as the total family kind of agenda and so on, and the difficulties and complications and complexities of being able to deal with that. But if you take a step back from those kind of issues, there is a debate, again, academically, certainly politically, about what the role of local authorities actually is. This may differ, the statements I'm about to make, but you'd expect me in a place like Liverpool to say that the role is much more than just about service delivery. Whether you go with the jargon of place shaping, whether you go with the public-private, the emphasis being on public-private rather than private sector, whether you go with dependency points, again, that Tony was making a little bit earlier, it is clear that certain parts of the country, in my view, have to operate, have to function, have to work, have to relate differently to the challenges they face than other parts. Having a one-size-fits-all approach to it, as I have to say successive governments have tended towards, doesn't help us to meet the challenges that we face. And again, the question about the resource review, I think, just bears that kind of complexity and that challenge out. Process excellence. Define what we mean by excellence. Define what we mean by process. we've all got examples. You'll have loads of examples in your own organisations. I could bore you rigid examples in various organisations I've worked in where we pride ourselves. In fact, we win awards for being more excellent than other places, than having better processes, better systems, having reduced the number of fingerprints on certain paper-based processes, new computerised systems that we've all developed and so on. I am very simple about this. I always think in the old-fashioned systems theory, inputs, black box, outputs, outcomes. Too much of the dialogue, too much of the conversation, too many meetings, too much time is spent on the input side, not enough on the outcome side. And my logic says, in the total family approach, as I understand it, works from the outcome side right the way back through the system. Focus on the outcomes, change the system. Don't try and do it the other way round. It fails. And what I'm about to say on some aspects of procurement and shared services hit that buffer full on. And I'll talk about those, obviously, in a second or two. So process excellence, please define. Service excellence, please define. For me, it is about what the customers say, what the residents say, what the taxpayers say. OK, we'll go with what the government says now that they've reduced the inspection burdens. But it's not what we say. Too much of it historically is being dependent on what we say, what we think, what our professional expertise says. You'll all be going through consultation processes on your budgets this time round. I've been absolutely fascinated and very impressed by the leap that local government generally has made about consulting and engaging on budget issues. Even as recently as 4 or 5 years ago, most places would do the token consultation, Volcom, umbrella organisation, Chamber of Commerce, one or two pet businesses, job done, budget put to bed. Where's the customer feedback in that kind of issue? Where's the constructive challenge, the critical friend analysis? Where's the partnership and partner agenda in that equation? So the kind of enrichment of budgeting around consultation with the right emphasis on value for money and the emphasis on outcomes again rather than efficiency is where I would want this conversation to be based. Some aspects of the reality around shared services and procurement. A tale of two trucks. It's not a spelling mistake, you'd be glad to know. Tale of two trucks. Those of you who might live in an environment where there's a road that splits two local authorities. I've been trying the last couple of days to see if I can get a photo of this, but I've failed miserably. But I will find one, because I know two specific examples. Liverpool, Knowsley, Liverpool, Sefton. Shared boundaries. You drive across a road, literally across the other side of a road. You're in a different borough, but you're in the same catchment. You're in the same set of communities, the same dynamics, the same social and economic challenges and deprivation and so on. The two trucks is the bin lorries, often on the same day, more often than not probably on different days. One side of the street gets a service from X authority, the other side of the street gets a service from Y authority. These are the same people we're talking about. They're not different people just because they happen to live on one side of the road than the other. Why, oh why, oh why have we not sorted integrated approaches to something as fundamentally important to local residents and customers as bin lorries? This is not rocket science. I've tried it and failed in the northeast. I've tried it and failed in Lancashire, where it's a slightly different dynamic because of county and district issues. I've tried it and failed in the Liverpool City region, or Merseyside as we used to call it. I'll come and try it somewhere else if you want, but I guarantee it will fail. Why does it fail? Obviously because it's not the right thing to do, so to speak. But it fails because we don't focus on the customer. You'll all have legion examples where contracts don't align, where specifications aren't right, and so on and so forth. There's 1,001, just on that one example, 1,001 excuses that are used. The reality is it doesn't happen, there's no change, because we forget the customer. We look at it through the prism of politics, one level, increasingly moving away from that, incidentally. I'll talk about that in a second. But more importantly, the message and the experience I have is that we pass the responsibility as good chief execs and with the leaders all agreeing that this is the right thing we should be doing. Who do we give the job to sort out the two bin lorries problem? contract manager or director, I'll use the example in Liverpool, or the contract manager and the director in Sefton. Why does it not happen? Because we've given it to the contract manager, director in Liverpool, contract manager, director in Sefton. We have got to find a different approach, a different strategy, a different set of change management processes that stop that happening. I could give you examples around legal, I could give you examples around estates, give you examples around architects, those of you who still have them, give you examples around finance, treasury management, here's a nice one. How many finance people are in the room? I know Andrew's a finance guy. Are you a finance guy? But you could be, couldn't you? Who knows about treasury management, just as a for instance? Treasury management, where the guys who operate on big calculators work out how to make you the maximum return on the savings and investments that you make in any given time. It's a great business, and those who are good at it are really good at it, I can assure you that. Why have we each got one of those? Why? Why have we each got a set of service accountants, not the guys who actually put the numbers together and make the numbers balance when you come to the annual accounts and get it through your members for budgeting purposes, but the day-to-day stuff? Why? We could pool those. We could collectivise them. They're all professional people. They know how to do numbers. They know how to balance budgets. They know largely about services and those kind of issues. Why don't we do it? Vested interest, turkeys for Christmas, and an ongoing theme which I'll develop around trust and respect and relationships. Because we've always had them, therefore we want to keep them. And I come back to my trucks example. If we want to change that, who do we pass it to change? The very people who want to stay there. Because they've got empires, they've got careers, they've got turf, they've got people working to them, they've got information, control. And those barriers are the ones that we need to be able to sort through. Who bears the upfront costs is actually a very significant issue. Even if we sort out the people issues, even if we sort out the politics, even if we sort out the turf, the next barrier becomes it's going to cost a little bit of money to sort this out. It's going to cost a bit of money to buy out of contract X in order to allow align to contract Y. Therefore, we won't do it, will we? The fact that it would save us 3-4 times that amount of money over a 10, 15, 20-year period seems, even to the most professional of us, the most common sense of us, to be a reason why we wouldn't do it. We've taken £91 million out of our budget, and I'll give you on one hand the number of shared services that we're doing. Why is that? And I can replicate that across the whole parts of the north. I won't speak about the south, but I can across the north. That's a big challenge for all of us. And the other point I will make is there's no quick wins. This is not easy. I think all of us have dealt with the low-hanging fruit, the efficiencies. That agenda has been around as long as I can remember. If you can find more efficiencies than I can in my organisation, please come and spend a couple of days with me. You'd be more than welcome. Efficiency ain't going to do it by itself. It's very important that we're efficient, obviously, but it ain't going to sort it by itself. Notwithstanding what others will say to you later on today, procurement won't sort it by itself. It can help, and it does help. Smart, intelligent procurement does help. It doesn't sort it by itself. Mindsets, therefore, need to change right through the system, from politicians to chief executives, to directors, to frontline staff, right through the system. But underpinning that is this point about trust and respect and relationships, because just because I say we'll do it doesn't actually work. Sometimes it does. More often it doesn't. Saying why we need to do it and winning the hearts and minds is what does or doesn't work, the hearts and minds. And that's as true externally as it is internally in the organisation. Thou shalt went out a long time ago. We need to is the kind of language and the approach that we need to take. But if we're going to do the we need to, you need a relationship. It's got to be more than one side of this in order to balance and to get people willing to make the change and to make the change happen. I'll have to have a little dig at procurement because otherwise it wouldn't be right, would it? Procurement is incredibly expensive, it's incredibly time-consuming, it takes a lot of expertise, and that's not a disparaging comment, it takes a lot of expertise to do this properly. Those people that think it's about supplies, and you're in the wrong business. Those people that think commissioning is somehow different to procurement are in the wrong business. Those people who think contracts are things that only nasty, horrible private sector people who make profits are in the wrong business. Procurement is a very, very complex area of activity. We, collectively, as a generalisation, have undervalued that in local government, in my opinion, because we have treated it as the commodities. So, proverbially, the pencils, the paper, the pens and all that kind of stationery stuff. Where's the agenda that looks to collectivise the procurement of energy? Which, when I was talking about my senior management team on Tuesday, is the single biggest pay and prices challenge that we've got in next year's budget. I've stopped them on everything else. I haven't won yet on energy. Because we used to do pay and prices inflation, but energy is so volatile that we are literally at the behest of the marketplace on that issue. And that ain't going to change, as I see it, for the next decade. So why are we not having a collectivised national local government approach to energy purchase? Why don't we use the leverage that we've got from a government point of view, from a public sector point of view, even from a place point of view, if you aggregate all your public sector through one set of contracts around energy? Why don't we do it? Because we haven't got the expertise, and it's a big risk. Because the big risk is, what happens if it doesn't work? Because we don't get our own bill, therefore we can't guarantee the security of the energy supply, can we? We ought to start looking beyond the straightforward pens and pencils kind of approach to it. We also need to manage procurement better. We all know that particularly bigger contracts are EU-based, and therefore they take a huge amount of time. But do we share the expertise generated from procurement? Let's use an old-fashioned example from last century, BSF. The number of places that spawned very expensive approaches to purchasing, procuring schools is frightening and reflects really badly on local government, in my opinion. You just look through the value chain of that procurement of any school that you want to name and take. The overhead, beyond the straightforward design of a building called a school, the overhead could have been stripped, made much more efficient and collectivised by block purchasing and block procurement of that particular issue. I'll just finish on two points. One is that we need to look at tomorrow's issues rather than just the issues of today. And I'll just take a step back from that, literally a step back from it. The number of all of us in this room who are part of conversations that talk about how it used to be yesterday rather than how it is today, and how many of us are talking about how it's going to be tomorrow and the day after. The pressures, the change agenda we've just been discussing, the financial climate that we're all in, the economic global climate and so on, the uncertainties that brings means that all of our worldviews, generally speaking, are here. The expectations of our customers, our citizens, our residents, people who pay our wages, are here. We need to be from here to there, proverbially speaking. We need to use all the tools, all the techniques, all the leverage that we've got available to us to be able to make that leap. And procurement and shared services is clearly an important part of that. A rhetorical question, hopefully, to this audience, but my perspective is that we need to take a longer term and more strategic focus on these kind of issues than just the today problem of the financial balance. And we need different approaches to the organisational dynamics, different approaches to the people dynamics, and different approaches to the boundaries, whether departmental, organisational, geographical, the two trucks kind of analogy. You'll all have examples of those galore. Procurement and shared services can help in that. They can help in that. But too much talk, not enough action. Happy to take any questions.
Hello, Okay. Questions for Jeb? Dool? Oh, Gifty? Have we got any more?
Hello, I'm Gifty Adela from Lunderborough Hackney. I can identify with a lot of the things you've said. You talked about process excellence, service excellence. One of the things we've been grappling with is if we're going to continue to make the level of cuts that Tony Travers have talked about for many years to come, can we really continue to provide service excellence or just simply a good service? Is it about the Rolls Royce or is it about the fit-for-purpose Mini, which will still get us to our destination? It's what we're grappling with. Can I just quickly finish up by saying I was talking to a group of people recently. We're really amazed with the development in Liverpool. When you come out of the station, it's that wow factor in Liverpool, so well done to you all.
Thank you. A compliment's always gratefully received. That's a great question. Is it Rolls-Royce or is it Mini? I think my take on that is that we should be guided by that, in answering that, by what our customers and our service users, the recipients of service and so on, actually say. And therefore, the point I was trying to make a little bit earlier about the consultation, the engagement piece, I think is a fundamental shift and a fundamentally important shift in that whole agenda. Because it's a bit like I was talking with Joyce over coffee about the NHS agenda and clinicians and where the power base is around health agenda. We have the same. We have professionals who specify and say that it needs to be done this way. Regardless of the cost, we'll just issue a blank check. And somebody in the centre picks up the bill, aggregates it, and says we can't afford it. But somehow we don't engage, we haven't until recently, engaged the wider population with a lot of the complexities of that decision making. Now, there's some great tools online. We use an online kind of consultation tool which takes people through a range of decisions. And they all come to the end of it and say, we can't do it. I say, welcome to our world. But the important point behind that is that we need to inform and tell people who are not necessarily service users, but are paying directly or indirectly, obviously, for the various services that we provide, the 700 odd that we apply in Liverpool, for instance, because they don't know. Why don't they know is because we haven't never told them. We've been absolutely dreadful at that aspect of communicating and what, if we were a commercial organisation, we'd refer to as marketing. And I think we're playing catch-up on that. We needed to. We need to catch up an awful lot quicker than we do. So it's not to duck your question, because I think the question's a fantastic one and well worthy of debate. But my answer would be guided by that which people would prefer to be able to pay within some kind of tolerances. Clearly, when we're talking about safeguarding issues or we're talking about demographics, adult social care, for instance, I think a slightly different dynamic. But street scene services, bin collection, what a great example that is at the moment around who should specify, the government or actually local people? Local people who are paying local council tax for local services, etc.
Yeah. I'd just like to, if there's no other questions for the moment, I'd just like to use my my chair's position and abuse it and ask both of you gentlemen if we need to look forward to what next. 10 years ago when I, about 15 years ago when I was first in local government journalism, I would never have foreseen where we've got to now. How do we know what the next 10 years is going to bring?
Yeah, I mean, that's also obviously a fantastic question. I will still be around in 10 years' time, probably, because Eric will make sure that people like us need to work and get the maximum out of us. I would like to see, but in a fair kind of crystal ball gazing, a situation where it's less about turf and territory and institutions than it is about service delivery and making a difference to communities and to people and life chances and all that kind of grand stuff. Because that's why I got into local government in the first place. That's why I have stayed in all seriousness. And I think people like me, like us, need to engage much more in the neighbourhood agenda, the localism agenda, the kind of council tax agenda we were just touching on a second ago, and break down the barriers. So I've spent a lot of time working in partnerships of various guises in all the different places I have.
why, sometimes it's a tactical thing, sometimes it's a financial reason, but actually, genuinely, it is about how do we, between us, make the most difference to these people, these places. And I think we need to do an awful lot more of that with a little bit less of the financial pressures kind of driver than the how do we make a difference driver. And I think we need to, I mean, we're obviously all struggling financially at the moment. Once we get through that, I think we need to kind of have the head held up and look outwards rather than downwards and inwards, would be my kind of answer.
And have you got a crystal ball, Tony?
Well, I mean... No. there's no doubt, I mean, just building on Jed's final point, last point there, I mean, it is always possible when there is a recession or some sort of austerity ongoing to think that it'll never, ever be different to this. And it, we, you know, in the sense that we all thought the boom would never end, well, you know, it did, and this will end too. But and I'm unusually optimistically. One, the present government doesn't have any proposals to reform the boundaries of local government. Local government is kind of safe for the foreseeable future. I think that's quite a good thing. Secondly, local government in Britain, in England, is incredibly financially strong. Local authorities in the UK have vast reserves and investments, which make them a far better place to lend money than many sovereign governments. That's a way of seeing how robust British local government is. And it's well managed. I mean, I think that, you know, the problem local government often has is that it is, partly because of the council tax, it's open to more scrutiny, and because of elections, more scrutiny and criticism than large other parts of the public sector, which apparently are funded by magic. The council tax makes people very alert to the fact they're paying for local government in a way they're not aware they're funding anything else. And I don't want to witter on, but I mean, it's interesting. The government's announced it's going to freeze council tax next year. Freeze council tax. An odd thing to do for a government that's desperate for every farthing it can get, but still, there we are. That's going to cost around £800 million. Because they recently put up VAT from 17.5% to 20%, which is a 14% increase on the base, and that's going to bring in probably, well, about sort of 12 to 15 billion, okay? So a tax increase of 15 billion, nobody notices. Holding council tax down by 800 million, hurrah, marvellous. And that just tells you how much difficulty local government has, precisely because it has a tax which in many ways, council tax, is a good one because it makes us aware of it. So, I'm more optimistic about local government's capacity to continue than I might have been in the past, but there is the issue of when will all of this end and when we can go, can we go back to slightly more optimistic, forward-looking way of planning the future, probably in about 5 or 6 years' time. So we will get there.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen.